The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you know where to send those comments. Send them to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you to Richard Palmer for filling in on yesterday's program. I understand he commented briefly on the mess down in London with the tube shutting down, or at least large portions of it around central London. And we happened to be victims of all of that craziness. We were not traveling on the tube, but we're in our car trying to get over to the U.S. Embassy to update some or renew some passports. As someone told me later in the day, there's actually quite a few people all around London that have vehicles, that have cars, but they just don't use them as much because there's so much traffic. So they rely heavily on the tube, on the subway system. And so when that shuts down, everyone resorts to cars, and then you come upon what we came upon yesterday morning, a tangled mess. We got, I think, within about 12 miles of the embassy before we finally realized we were going to miss our appointment and decided to just turn around and head back. We gave some thought to turning around and finding a tube station because we knew that some of the tube lines were open, but as I think Mr. Palmer covered with you yesterday, that led to quite a lot of chaos down in the tube with people descending upon the lines that were open because others were shut down. So I'm glad we decided not to do that and just head back. And I guess we'll have to take care of some of that paperwork at a later date. In any event, it does highlight. Here's London, one of the most sophisticated and prosperous high-tech cities in the world. And yet look at what happens. When just one thing shuts down, just one thing. Here at Edstone, we had a power line go out just yesterday, the main line coming into the Edstone facility. Thankfully, about half of the facility here has power, but the half that doesn't, including down here in the cellar, a lot of it's in the dark right now, and I've been prepped on what to do when the lights go out, if it happens. But when one thing like that, one convenience, modern technology, when it goes haywire, look at the impact it can have on a facility or on a city or on an entire nation. And then think about some of these prophecies that we talked to you about on this program. Already we're seeing, I mean, what a tangled and chaotic world it is. In so many different ways, you throw human nature into the mix. Of course, human nature, I'm sure, was behind the tube strike. I don't know all the details or the grievances, but typically it boils down to money, you know, getting more. And if you don't get more, then you shut it down and people pay the price. But then add to that all of the acts of violence and hatred that you see brought on by human beings with very powerful weapons, in the case of this killer in Fort Lauderdale, who evidently got into some kind of a dispute while flying down to Florida, and then went to baggage claim, got his gun out of his bag, and went into the bathroom, loaded it up, and then proceeded to shoot five people. Well, more than that, there were several that were injured, but he killed five people at point-blank range. That was just, Friday night? And then the terrorist attack in Jerusalem. Here again, someone commandeering a large truck or lorry and looking for a pile of people, a crowd of people to plow into. I mean, there's been no let-up on these violent atrocities so far with this new calendar year. Beginning with the attack in Turkey, just hours into this calendar year. That terrorist attack there, and then another one again on Sunday in Jerusalem. And they're using the trucks. That's the weapon of choice ever since Nice. 84 were killed back in that attack. And then more recently, you have 12 that were killed in Berlin. That was last month. And this time around, it's Jerusalem. Four soldiers killed. Three of them were women. And 13 were wounded. And some reports, and others have since disputed this, but some that were at the scene said that they were hesitant to shoot at the driver because of a high-profile case in Israel, where an Israeli months ago, or I don't know when the attack actually happened, but when the attacker was wounded, and then the Israeli went ahead and killed the attacker, and has since been found guilty of manslaughter. And so you have Israelis, some of them a little more skittish, to step up and defend themselves. But by the time the truck rammed through the crowd in Jerusalem and then proceeded to back up over the bodies to make sure that they were killed, then they finally knew this is a terrorist strike. And so they shot the driver. They shot the terrorist. This was when these soldiers were waiting for a bus. When we were there on the archaeological excavation years ago, well, we've been to several. But over the years, I mean, on a typical workday on Sunday, for example, you'll see a lot of soldiers coming through the City of David or touring through the Ophel or the Davidson Archaeology Park there at the Temple Mount, as the government wants their soldiers to know their history. And that's what they were involved in, this group of soldiers on Sunday. It was a culture Sunday trip, where these soldiers are taking on these educational tours right across the country to be reminded of just how far back the Jewish history goes in Judea, in Samaria, in Jerusalem. The Palestinian, well, I don't know the name of the website, but there was a website that published a photo of the terrorist who, as I said, was shot dead at the scene of the crime. And this website also published a photo of the daughter of this terrorist, or as they call him, a martyr. And this poor little girl, they show a distraught picture of her upon hearing the news of her father's execution, it says on this website. He was executed. The driver of this truck. That's the way the Palestinian sources, so many of them, report on these atrocities. There's cheering in the streets of Gaza. They hand out candy. That's the typical reaction. And the terrorist is seen as a martyr. Ynet News quoted the sister of the terrorist. She said that this is the most beautiful kind of saintly death. That's what she said about her brother. He was in his 20s. The father of four. And his family is celebrating this beautiful death, saintly death. The sister said, Allah chose him for this martyrdom. She said, we're patient, and we thank Allah for this. So this cold-blooded killer, this murderer, is a martyr. That's the way his family views this. And then, as I say, you have all the celebrations in Gaza. Anytime Israeli soldiers or anytime Israelis are killed. And so three women and a young man are killed. And Israel's neighbors shout for joy. Hamas's spokesman, he said on his Facebook page, this was reported at the Times of Israel, he said the continuous operations in the West Bank and Jerusalem prove that the Jerusalem Intifada is not an isolated event, but rather a decision by the Palestinian people to revolt until it attains its freedom and liberation from the Israeli occupation. It says these operations demonstrate that all attempts to bypass the resistance or to thwart it will fail every time. That's the Hamas spokesman calling for war. Imagine if in Nice or in Berlin, right after these truck rammings occur, if the neighbors from the community around Nice, or some of them anyway, or around the city of Berlin, came forward and started cheering the attack and started handing out candies on the streets of Berlin or the streets of Nice. That's not what happened over there. But in Israel, I mean, this is routine. This is customary. And you know what else is routine? The media coverage of it. Well, you compare the three. You could argue, well, there were fewer people that died in the one in Jerusalem, but that's the one that happened most recently. And yet there's just the short blurb on Sunday, and then it rolls down in the news cycle, and you don't really hear much more about it. And really, when you know what's going to happen to Jerusalem, I mean, this is even more significant in some ways. I mean, for sure, these attacks in Europe, too, they're awakening a beast. We know that. So both of them are having an impact on prophecy. But we've said for so many years, watch Jerusalem. And here comes the Hamas spokesman saying, this isn't the end. I mean, this is showing we're having great success. They had a great run of it using their knives, walking up from behind and just stabbing Israelis. And then people cheering those deaths. And now they see what success the terrorists have had in Nice and in Berlin. Well, hey, let's get into a truck. And you know about from years ago, bulldozers were used. I mean, really, this sort of tactic, it started in Israel. And now it comes back to Israel. A huge truck just ramming through a crowd of Israeli soldiers. And Israel's neighbors, their neighbors in their own neighborhood, rejoicing. And what's the cause of all of this, if we're to believe the Obama administration? Well, it's Israeli construction. Condominiums, daycare centers, anything like that that's being constructed. That's what's causing all of this violence. Now, for Berlin and Nice, we don't know all the causes, but we know it's horrific. And we know it demands all kinds of coverage. It needs to be spotlighted, and it needs to stop. In Israel, though, there's not nearly the level of concern or the coverage. And yet what all of this is building toward is this city being split right in two. It already is, culturally. But more violence is coming. That's what your Bible says. Zechariah 14 and verse 1. We haven't read this in a while, these two verses here at the start of chapter 14. But the prophet Zechariah says, behold, the day of the Lord comes, and your spoil shall be divided in the midst of you. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, it says, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished. And half the city, this is Jerusalem, half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. And so Zechariah here at the outset gives us, as my father's explained before, he gives us an overview of events that lead up to the return of Christ. He's going to gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. That's referring to when Jesus Christ will gather the armies of the world just before his return to Jerusalem. That's talked about later in the chapter, right here in Zechariah 14, when he sets foot on the Mount of Olives. But it says here in these first two verses, gathering the nations, and then you back up from that, it says, the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished. That's talking about when the king of the north conquers Jerusalem shortly after he conquers the king of the south. We'll look at that prophecy in just a little bit, if we have time with this segment. But then, as my father has said, before all of that, you have half of the city that goes forth into captivity. And that's talking about the Palestinians taking control of East Jerusalem This is something we've been forecasting for many, many years. The city shall be divided. Half shall go forth into captivity. And so for this reason, and other prophecies too, we've told you, it all revolves around Jerusalem. We've got to watch Jerusalem. We've had this new radio program, Watch Jerusalem, for some time, a month or two, I guess. Brent Noctegal, our reporter in Jerusalem, he's on the ground there. And you can be sure what happened over the weekend is something that's getting a lot of coverage there locally. But it's a shame, isn't it, that in the West we just see this as, well, it's customary. And frankly, and this is really in their heart of hearts, although they don't say it, frankly, if the Jews didn't do this, this, and this, those things wouldn't happen. And so there's just this built-in bias of wanting to blame the Jews for all the problems. I want to return back to this UN resolution from last month. Carolyn Glick did a good job in her recent column of just kind of summarizing all that's happened and really highlighting how despicable this action was by the United States. And particularly when you look at what's happening in this chaotic world, when you look at what's happening all around us. And this is what the Obama administration chose to really target. Building projects in East Jerusalem. Carolyn Glick says here, the world recently watched in horror. Before this, I won't get into the entire article, but before it, she talks about just even in Israeli culture, there's not this celebration of victory when Israelis return from battle. Really, they just return back to their families quietly. And her point is that they're not a warlike people. They don't want to fight. And well, they do want to construct things. They do want to build apartments. They do want to build accommodations. Now, again, this isn't meant to suggest that the Jews have done everything perfectly. Human nature is the problem. At its core, I mean, it's human nature through and through. And that's why it's not solvable with man's plans. But what Glick does in her article is she contrasts this way of life with the other celebrating, cheering the deaths of Israelis, celebrating the acts of so-called martyrs because they have the courage to get inside of a cab of a truck and then ram that truck through a crowd of civilians or innocents. The world recently watched in horror, Glick writes, as Aleppo burned, the massacre of men, women, and children shocking the world. I mean, this is just from December. The Syrian genocide reached fever pitch in December 2016, just as the Obama administration had but days left in office. But rather than scramble to save the children of Aleppo, President Barack Obama continued to not lift a finger to protect Arabs from being slaughtered. Turns out he and his national security team were too busy scheming against Israel to take notice. Aleppo was ignored as the administration focused instead on condemning the Jewish state with a UN resolution that will lead to economic boycotts against Israel and the possible detention and arrests of its soldiers, like my son, she says, and its ministers, when they travel abroad. Worst of all, the resolution will almost certainly lead to Israeli leaders and military figures being prosecuted at the International Criminal Court at The Hague. I mean, she's breaking it down to talk about how this really will impact Israel as a state and the lives of Israeli leaders and soldiers. Even as all of these atrocities are going on around the world, President Obama couldn't pass even one UN Security Council resolution condemning Russia, Syria, and Iran for the wholesale carnage in Syria. I mean, can you believe that? Not one resolution aimed at the carnage in Syria. Not one resolution against Russia or Syria or Iran, but instead little Israel because of the construction projects. She says, but they passed a motion condemning Jews who build condominiums in Judea and Samaria, the ancient biblical cradle of Jewish civilization. She says here, but the biggest failure of all was Obama's blindness on the real causes of conflict in the region. Men who are taught they will be granted virgins for murder, sex, for violence, are creating a culture where harming others is the ultimate test of masculinity and manhood. But contrast, men who are taught that fighting is never something to celebrate, but rather to be used only in the defense of life, are those who will ultimately sow peace. Hence, Hamas building weapons rather than Jews building homes is the ultimate source of the conflict. Hamas could easily have used Israel's withdrawal in 2005 and the billions it received in international aid to build homes as well. But that would not have brought glory. Firing rockets at Israel made them into truly religious men. This is what brings them glory, and the perfect example is from the reports after Sunday's attack. The sister of the terrorist saying, we couldn't be happier. He's a martyr. Allah is the one who chose him to commit this act. Says, for the past few years, President Obama watched impotently as ISIS took control over a quarter of the country, targeting Yazidis and Christians. As Iran-backed Shiite Muslims joined Alawites seeking to exterminate the Sunnis. That's going on in the nation that borders Israel in the north, Syria. Not one resolution, though, aimed at Syria, Iran, Russia, none of them. For Israel, though, it's different. Well, I'm kind of repeating some of what we discussed on Friday. Why so much hatred aimed at the Jews? You've got to go and study that passage I mentioned on Friday's show, the Key of David booklet. I forget which chapter. But Satan is filled with wrath. And he hates. He's cast down to this earth, and he's confined to this earth, and he hates spiritual Jews first and foremost. And he certainly hates the Jewish people as well. How else do you explain this? How else do you explain this upside-down reasoning? This perverse reasoning? It says here, his administration has been ambivalent about stopping Syria's largest city being turned into a kill zone, where at least 100,000 children are trapped beneath the falling barrel bombs. I mean, just tens of thousands of children suffering. Suffering. Arab children. And no one doing a thing. A genocide has unfolded before our eyes, but rather than focusing its efforts on stopping the brutality in Aleppo, the lame duck president and his cohorts decided that Jews building nurseries in Beit El was a greater danger than mustard and sarin gas attacks against Arab children in Damascus. Carolyn Glick says, by engineering UNSC Resolution 2334, a resolution that will live in infamy, Team Obama has emboldened Israel's enemies and made peace much less likely. That's how all of this is connected. Watch Jerusalem. Watch Jerusalem, we've been saying. And now you have this final act of the Obama administration on the way out, this Antiochus type. And it's going to make peace so much less likely. By approving the resolution's absurd language that Israel's claim to the Western Wall and Jerusalem's Jewish quarter has no legal validity, that's a quote from the resolution, and ignoring the Jewish people's 3,000-year-old connection to Judea and Samaria, the Obama administration only encourages Palestinian jihadists to cling to their dreams of driving the Jews into the sea. No wonder Hamas and Iran-backed Islamic Jihad, who are dedicated to Israel's destruction, have praised it. I mean, they love the resolution. They praised it. They were cheering for that, like they were cheering for this terrorist attack on Sunday. It says in his speech about the resolution, John Kerry said, it is vital that we have an honest, clear-eyed conversation about the uncomfortable truths. And then Glick says, here are just a few of them, a few of the uncomfortable truths. No agreement, including the Oslo Accord, signed by the Palestinians, precludes Israel from building settlements in Judea and Samaria. In fact, even two-state proponents acknowledge Israel's right to annex the major settlements as part of a land swap in the final peace agreement. I mean, that's been discussed in every single one of these discussions. Israel's not precluded, even according to the current arrangements, the current discussions, from these construction projects. She says further, the West Bank territory is disputed. It's not occupied. It was never a sovereign Palestinian state. Now, ask your average college student in the United States if that's the case. Just clueless about the history. Even the recent history, going back to when Jordan controlled the so-called West Bank up until 1967, of course. It was never a sovereign Palestinian state. After the expulsion of Jews 2,000 years ago, the land was occupied by many nations, most recently by the Ottomans, British, and Jordanians. Only in 1967, after Israel defeated Jordan in the Six-Day War, did claims of illegal occupation become fashionable. It's been only since 1967. It says, after all, which legal entity did Israel illegally occupy it from? The Ottoman Empire? The British Mandate? Certainly not from any state called Palestine. I mean, really, just looking at it logically, if anyone has a grievance here, it's the state of Jordan. But Jordan's the one that attacked. Going back to that history from 67, she says, finally, what a tragedy for the legacy of Barack Obama, whose countless assurances of having Israel's back have proven worthless. It says, already tainted by the Iran deal, his legacy will be stained by this cowardly stab in Israel's back in the fleeting days of his presidency. That's from Carolyn Glick's latest. Obama and Israel, it's titled, The Final Insult. Well, as I covered on Friday's program last week, we've been talking about this as well, this development, the division between the United States and little Judah. The little Israeli state, Zechariah 11:14, Hosea 5 is another important prophecy about Judah being wounded by the peace deal and having to turn to Assyria, having to turn to modern-day Germany because there's no help there from Manasseh. There's no help coming from the United States, and neither is it coming from Ephraim. Ephraim's sick, it says in Hosea 5. And what is all of this leading to? Well, that same passage, Hosea 5, says that Israel or the United States and Ephraim, the UK, they're going to fall in their iniquity and Judah's going to fall with them. That's where all of this brotherly division is leading. That's where we're headed. I mentioned a bit ago about that clash between the king of the north and the king of the south. Let me just read for you those two verses again in Daniel 11. You know them well if you've listened to this program at all over the years. Daniel 11:40 says, and at that time of the end, or at the time of the end, shall the king of the south push at him. That's radical Islam headed up by Iran, the number one state sponsor of terrorism. And their fingerprints are all over what's happening in Syria. Same with Putin's. No resolutions aimed at them, though. Here's the pushing, push and push and push. It says, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. That's the clash, Daniel 11:40. Catholic Europe against radical Islam in the Middle East, headed up by Iran. And then verse 41 says, and he shall enter also into the glorious land. And you can read the rest of the chapter about, again, it centers around Jerusalem. And so we wait for the division of the city, the division of Jerusalem, and then the clash of these two kings, the king of the north and the king of the south. And then the king of the north, the German-led king of the north, entering into Jerusalem, looking like a peacekeeping force. And then everything breaks down. Great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world, Jesus said, to this time. I mean, nothing like it. That's where all of this is leading. But you don't want to forget about the rest of Zechariah 14, as I alluded to earlier, because it does finally result in the return, the literal return of Jesus Christ, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, to this earth, beginning there at the Mount of Olives. And then the establishment, of course, of God's kingdom on earth. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email the program. If we have time, we'll get to a few more emails in just a bit. You can email those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means city of peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
In recent months, I've been referring to this verse, Isaiah 58 and verse 1, and how that verse or that passage impacted Herbert Armstrong early on in his ministry, and just his awareness of the fact that he had to lift up his voice, like it says in that verse, like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sins. That's in Isaiah 58 and verse 1. And as I was recently discussing with the students at Armstrong College, really, it's an exciting study. The entire chapter Isaiah 51, where you see what we need to be doing in order to really get behind this message that goes out like a trumpet. Because as I've said before, I mean, it does take courage to get the message out there. It's not a popular message. You can read at the outset of Ezekiel's prophecy, in Ezekiel 2 and chapter 3, chapter 2 in particular, where God is telling his prophet, look, you be courageous. You're going to have to be strong. You're going to have to be tough. Because they're not going to like your message. Well, when you read Isaiah 58, when you see the verses that follow that commission to cry aloud and spare not, notice what God gets into. This is Isaiah 58 in verse 2. It says, yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways as a nation that did righteousness and forsook not the ordinance of their God. They ask of me the ordinance of justice. They take delight in approaching to God. The start of that verse there where it says, they seek me daily and delight to know my ways as a nation. And that really should read as if a nation. In other words, as if they're an obedient people. God here is condemning hypocrisy. I mean, if his work is out there telling the house of Jacob their sins, God doesn't want hypocrites delivering that kind of a message. And so we've got to be people who will confront our own sins and get rid of them. And then that's when God can really amplify the message. Verse 3 says, why have we fasted? And you see it not. Why have we humbled ourselves? And you take no knowledge of it. Behold, in the day of your fast, you seek your own pleasure, God says, and oppress all your workers. You're not fasting the right way. Your attitude isn't right, he says. You think about that example in Luke 18 with the two men that went up to pray. You had one that was a Pharisee who was thanking God that he wasn't like all these other horrible sinners around him. I mean, he felt like he was righteous. He was sinless. And then the publican, of course, could not so much as lift his eyes up to heaven. And he asked God to be merciful with him, a sinner. That's the kind of attitude that God's looking for. It says elsewhere in the Gospels that our righteousness has to exceed It has to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Verse 4 here, it says, this is Isaiah 58, behold, you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to hit with wicked fist. This is from the Revised Standard Version. Fasting like yours this day will not make your voice to be heard on high. I mean, that's not how you get through to God. And yet we do want to. We want to have our voice heard on high. How do we do it? Well, fast the right way. That's certainly one important tool that true Christians use. Verse 5 says, is it such a fast that I have chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head as a bulrush and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Will you call this a fast and an acceptable day to the Eternal? We can't go into it looking to get something in return or to be seen of men or of God like that Pharisee in Luke 18. That's just vanity, and God abhors that. But verse 6 says, is not this the fast that I've chosen, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke? That's the attitude or approach that we take going into a fast. We pray that God would loose those bands of wickedness. We ask God to help us see ourselves for who and what we are. We fast, among other things, to change ourselves, to draw closer to God, and to make changes. And then when you continue reading in this wonderful passage, Isaiah 58, then you see how strongly God reacts to someone who fasts in a right attitude. Verse 7 says, Is it not to deal your bread to the hungry? And that you bring the poor that are cast out to the house? When you see the naked, that you cover him? And that you hide not yourself from your own flesh? This is the kind of fast God chooses. And when we go before him in this kind of a humble and self-searching attitude, when we go before him and ask for him to help us root out the lawlessness and to bring us closer to him, then we can really get behind God's work and deal with those who are hungry spiritually and who are poor spiritually and give them what they need and give them hope and give them God's truth. Verse 8 says, "Then shall your light break forth as the morning, and your health shall spring forth speedily, and your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Eternal shall be your rear reward," or your rear guard or protection. That's when you can really break through to God and see huge open doors for his work. Of course, there are do's and don'ts when it comes to serving God. There are commandments. There are constraints on the one hand, and there's also the have-tos. The crying out to God, the prayer, the study, the occasional fasting. But the rewards that God showers upon the obedient. The blessings that God brings into our lives. Verse 9 says, "Then shall you call, and the Lord shall answer." What a blessing that is, to have God respond. "And you shall cry, and he shall say, 'Here I am.'" He'll be there for you. He'll be right there. And if you take away from the midst of you the yoke, the putting forth of the finger and speaking vanity, look at the powerful impact this kind of fasting has on the individual Christian and on the work of God. That's when we can really break through to God and grow. It says in verse 10, "And if you draw out your soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then shall your light rise in obscurity, and your darkness be as the noonday." It says, "And the Lord shall guide you continually and satisfy your soul in drought and make fat your bones, and you shall be like a watered garden and like a spring of water whose waters fail not." When you go into a fast, if you do it to draw closer to God and to seek power from God to break the bands of wickedness that slow us down, those sins that so easily beset us, as Paul said in Hebrews, God really responds. There's some pretty amazing examples in the Bible. When you see it done on a group level, like it was anciently in Israel, King Jehoshaphat is one example of that. He was faced with an invasion. And, of course, most kings would immediately bring together his war cabinet and draw up some kind of military strategy. But what the scriptures tell us about Jehoshaphat is that he feared God, and he set himself to seek God. And he proclaimed a fast throughout Judah. How would God respond if little Judah has a lot of problems, as I said to you in the first segment? How would God respond if all of the people of Judah today beseeched God, humbling in fasting and prayer? It says, "So Judah gathered together to ask help from the Lord, and from all the cities of Judah, they came to seek the Eternal." That's discussed in 2 Chronicles 20, that history. Everyone got involved, men, women, children, everyone fasted. And God responded, and the answer came fast. They were told to go out and to meet the invaders and to trust God to settle it, to trust God to take care of them. And so coming off of this fast, Jehoshaphat, he led the people out the next day. They came on this, well, you can read the passage yourself in 2 Chronicles 20, but what a strange sight. Here is this oncoming army, and the invaders turned against one another. And the entire army was, well, they just were wasted away. They killed themselves. God responded. God delivered Judah. That's the power of a godly fast. Fasting shows God. If it's done right, it shows God that we are willing to rely on God and His strength, not our own physical resources, but on God and His power. It's another pretty amazing example in 1 Kings 21. This one, with respect to Ahab. If you know anything about Old Testament history, you know that Ahab was one evil character. He was evil through and through. And the prophet Elijah spent years witnessing to him. And Ahab didn't repent. The Bible says there was no one like Ahab who sold himself to do wickedness in the sight of the Eternal. There was nobody as evil as him. And yet, you get right to the end of the story. Elijah's final warning was of what would happen to Ahab's household. They were going to be cursed. They were going to suffer. And Ahab finally, this is in 1 Kings 21, it says he tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his body, and he fasted and lay in sackcloth, and he went about mourning. He started a fast, and God took note. God saw that here he was actually repentant this time. And so the promised punishment, it was postponed until after Ahab's death. God had mercy on King Ahab of all people. And it all turned around for him. When he turned to God, humbly and submissively, in fasting and prayer, as times get tougher, that's what it's going to take for true Christians to be tough themselves, because that spiritual toughness and strength that comes from God, spiritual growth, the power to overcome, that comes from God. And when we turn to God in this kind of an attitude and really work with His help and power to get the sins out of our lives, that's how the work of God really charges forward. And then you can just go out to the battlefield and watch God deliver you. And watch God rescue you. And watch God overpower that invading force. God really does respond to this kind of fasting, the kind of fasting described there in the middle of Isaiah 58. Or with that example of Jehoshaphat and the kingdom of Judah, and even Ahab as well. Some encouraging examples, to be sure. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll get into a few leftover emails that I didn't have time to get through on Friday. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of the Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
I'll start here with a great email that came in a couple weeks ago. I just haven't, again, gotten around to this one in particular. But he writes here saying, I am soon hoping to rejoin the brethren in fellowship and worship after a long time away. I have missed my family. Way back in the 1980s, I was a weekly watcher of the World Tomorrow TV program. With this program, the booklets, and the Plain Truth magazine, I grew in understanding and after time contacted the ministry. Those outreach programs were such a huge means of allowing me to hear God's call. I was later baptized about the same time as Mr. Armstrong died. I ended up leaving the church in early 1989. I blame no one. I left the church and rejoined the world. I had counted the cost, but I used the doctrinal changes to justify leaving God. It was years later that I came across Raising the Ruins. This book answered so many of the questions I had held inside for so long. I think it was 2010 when I received the copy. This helped me to locate the PCG. I began watching The Key of David. Like at the first, I started taking the booklets and the trumpet. I then started listening to the radio programs online and the Trumpet Hour. And this has led me to this point where I have now contacted the ministry. It says, my comment is, once I came into the church fellowship back in the 1980s, I continued watching The World Tomorrow, but I was a little surprised that so many within the church did not seek to, or rather seem to, think this was of benefit for them personally. I kept watching and reading as this was vital to my early growth. I'll soon join in worship and in this work from within. I would hope that the brethren recognize the value of these programs, not just to those outside the inner court, but the value they have to all those whom God has called. It says, finally, this is the work in action. Well, I think I can say, judging by a lot of the feedback and the emails that come in, there are quite a few that really do realize the value of these messages going out, the value of the literature and the publications, the monthly magazines, and so on. But sometimes it does take someone that's relatively new to the process. We take calls here every weekend. The people responding to our TV program here in the UK, and you do get a lot of appreciation from these callers. People that are very thankful to be receiving a booklet or a magazine or a book, whatever it is. You know the literature that we offer on TV each week. And so many newbies, you could call them. They really are appreciative to get the truth of God, to receive it from God's work. Well, this next email here, I think I mentioned on Friday just how much of a response we got to the program from a week or two ago on the daily pilgrimage. It's something that ties in with what we just discussed in the last segment. The focus on prayer, this here says, just a little confessing, submitting in humility my weakness and pray that I'll do that hour of intense, fervent, heartfelt prayers and more every day. This is picking it up in the middle of a thought. He says, I'm going to go back to this one, this program, this particular podcast. You can hear all of them, by the way, at thetrumpet.com or at kpcg.fm. But he says, I'm going to go back to this program again and again and repeat it until it really gets through to me. It says, finally, thank you from deep in my heart. Another one, this coming from New Mexico. It says, I've been a listener since August of 2016, so just in the last few months. I love all the programs you broadcast, and particularly this episode about our daily pilgrimage through prayer. I am in a journey of becoming a part of God's true church, and by listening to your program every day, it gives me strength to continue. Thank you for always feeding us with spiritual food. Another one here says, today's program was like a strong wind at my back. Prayer really does put you at the bloom of life, as Mr. Armstrong said. I remember Mr. Gerald Fleury asking this question once. What kind of son doesn't talk to his father? It has always motivated me. Just as Mr. Armstrong prayerfully fought to learn and boldly share God's revealed truth. Mr. Gerald Fleury then prayerfully embraced God's truth, restored through Mr. Armstrong. All this monumental success traces back to prayer. To prayer. It says further on, praise be to God for all our prayerful leaders. What a spiritual topic to springboard into the Sabbath with. Thank you for all of your efforts. Well, that's about all that we have time for. There's still even a few left over. If you'd like to send some comments to the program and possibly have them read over the air, send those to td@kpcg.fm. This is Stephen Fleury with the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.